91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks. As part of the ongoing initiative, American Graduate, Getting to Work, today we're taking a look at American workers. More and more often, workers in both blue-collar and white-collar jobs are working with or being replaced by automation or artificial intelligence. But is it as bad for people as it seems? With technology and robotics encroaching in the workforce, will we have to rethink the way jobs of the future are being done? We talk today with the authors of Automation and Artificial Intelligence, How Machines Are Affecting People and Places, Mark Muro and Robert Maxim of the Brookings Institution. They join me from Washington, D.C. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, thanks so much for having us.
Hi, Marianne. Great to be with you.
So let's start out just talking about what you found out in your report. What were you setting out to look for, and what are some of the basic things that you found?
Sure thing. So one of the things that's important to note about automation is it's not a new phenomenon. And so the way we talk about it, there are really several different forms of automation. There's, you know, robotics, which is kind of the industrial robots that you think about in the factory and the assembly line. There's software, which really over the past 20, 30 years has affected a significant number of white-collar workers, you know, admin workers, things like that. And then there's kind of this more emerging form of artificial intelligence, which is kind of a new form of automation affecting kind of a totally different class of workers. The workers that were affected the most were kind of middle-wage jobs, whether it is someone working on an assembly line, whether it is, you know, someone that is kind of a mid-career admin person within a white-collar setting. And so the kind of combination of both automation with broader globalization really affected those workers. And so that's, you know, that's been one of the big political stories really over the past half decade around, you know, not only the impacts on the heartland, but kind of left behind communities and kind of the forgotten man and woman. And that has kind of emerged as really a political theme over the past half decade. And we see the roots of that in kind of the impacts of automation over the past 30 to 40 years. Moving forward, you know, kind of the emergence of new technologies means it's going to affect different segments of the labor force. So, you know, one kind of emerging set of technology we see is, you know, on the robotics side, new forms of, in particular, customer service software and cobots, or kind of the robots that are operating side by side with people that are able to do kind of more nimble things and operate in new environments. And so, we, you know, based on kind of the assessment that we did, in particular, lower income workers are going to be more affected by these types of technologies. You know, think about whether it's a McDonald's employee who might be displaced by a self-ordering machine, or, you know, an Amazon warehouse that is able to operate with fewer and fewer human workers as robots are replacing the operations there. You know, that's kind of the new emerging group of workers that on the automation side we see as most at risk. And then there's kind of this question of artificial intelligence, which is kind of the newest form of automation when it comes to the labor market. And we're not totally sure, you know, what impacts that will have, because it is a relatively new technology. We don't have kind of 30 years of evidence to compare it against. But, you know, what our numbers show is the workers most likely to be affected by artificial intelligence moving forward are going to be actually higher income, you know, white collar workers that have kind of previously been impervious to automation in a lot of different forms. So that's going to have an interesting new dynamic around, you know, who is an affected worker and kind of what are the policy responses. And
I mean, this is Mark. I just throw in, you know, Ohio broadly and the greater Cincinnati area are absolute focal points of all of the trends that Rob is talking about. You know, so I think it's really important that your region's really deeply thinking about this. You know, in our measures of exposure, you're highly exposed in some ways, but you're also seeing potential growth in from all of this. So, you know, you're absolutely the focal point.
Yeah, Cincinnati in a lot of ways has kind of had a front row seat to a lot of the major transformations in the U.S. economy over the last couple of decades.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you've both said. And I think that is interesting that it is affecting this area. And it sounds from what you said about not only automation but artificial intelligence that really it goes across all sorts of work sectors. It's not just one area. Pretty much anybody could be affected by this.
Yeah.
Mark? Rob?
I was just going to say, broadly speaking, one of the good ways to think about artificial intelligence is kind of as a general purpose technology, much in the way that almost every job uses a computer now. Artificial intelligence is probably going to be similar in that it will touch on almost every job in some way, but it'll certainly affect some more than others. And so artificial intelligence specifically, one of the areas that we see as really being exposed is any sort of work that involves kind of prediction or perception or control. And so that's kind of a unique capability when it comes to AI. And maybe just, kind of stepping back a bit, when we talk about artificial intelligence, what we really mean is, new forms of basically computer algorithms that can do functions that were previously thought to be only possible by the human brain. And so we look at kind of a specific subset of that called machine learning, which is taking kind of these big data sets and using them to, in particular, make predictions or perceive patterns or improve the operations of different functions.
Can you give me an example of what one of those jobs might be? Because you're sort of talking in broad terms. I mean, is this like an insurance adjuster and they can just feed all that information into a computer or, when they're figuring out just how much to charge for things like that? What kind of jobs specifically would that affect?
Yeah, certainly. So a couple that kind of come to mind, a financial analyst is kind of the classic example where, previously they would be assessing the performance of portfolios over, days, weeks, years, decades, and trying to make predictions moving forward about, what companies, what stocks would be worthwhile to buy for the benefit of their clients. Another example is, an operations specialist in maybe a factory that's looking for, kind of defects coming off the line, maybe a quality control inspector. And so each of those jobs have different components of either prediction or perception or control that, previously has been done mostly by humans, but this kind of new set of algorithms is able to detect patterns and, whether it's leveraged by people doing their job moving forward or able to kind of replace some workers in their entirety will be affecting the labor force.
Or even marketing's a huge one.
Yeah.
That's a good point. A lot of people are marketing things in America.
Yeah.
And it's a classic example where you're trying to connect research with a prediction of behavior.
Yep.
In a place like Cincinnati, where you've got a huge, a big professional services or management of companies, all of that work is affected by this. I think the good point that my colleague Rob is making here is, you've lived through, the massive dislocations of robotics in the manufacturing sector. You've been a focal point absolutely for that. But really, no zone of the economy and no group of occupations seems to have, zero impact. I mean, certainly, personal care, direct human interaction, some of those kinds of interpersonal occupations, seem to have minimal change ahead. But really, I think we should all be penciling in a lot of change in the next 15 years.
Mark, talk a little bit more just about how regions can help prepare for that then. If the work is going to go away or different types of work will be maybe people will have to change the type of jobs they do, how can a community help prepare for what's coming?
And you're right that This is varied by place. That's what's interesting. There are places that are much more affected than others. So, we do think that a lot of the responses are best delivered at the regional level. So, I think broadly it starts with a readiness to change and, what we call a constant education mindset. We're all going to have to be ready to quickly reskill, learn new skills, remain calm in the face of a lot of change, and get better at quickly upskilling. And I think that applies to incumbent workers also. It's not just waiting to act and react until you're thrown out of a job. It's about being ready to adapt. But also I think we need to get a lot better at you know, helping people adjust or help every – we need to get better, more comfortable with constant change. But we really don't have the kind of policies and training systems that allow people to more routinely move from one thing to another, including with maybe spates of non-work where they're learning something new. All of that's really important.
And how long do you think it'll take people just to adapt to all of that? I mean, is it just ongoing? People should always be prepared for these changes that are coming?
I just to kind of hop in, you know, I think it is, you know, certainly something that workers should be thinking about consistently. I think part of the reason that is because, you know, the reality is if you are displaced, it can be a several-year process. You know, anyone that's kind of gone through a job search, whether they're kind of immediately coming out of their undergrad or high school or whether it's kind of a career, you know, at a minimum, it's a lot of time, 6 months. If you've kind of had a career for years or decades and you're displaced, it could be several years. And part of the reason that is in particular for you know, workers that have been in a career for a significant amount of time, years, decades, you know, they've often either been in a similar job or similar company culture. And if they're displaced, if they're laid off, if their job is replaced by a robot, a lot of this applies to if their job goes overseas as well, right? You know, they have a pretty specific skill set that they've developed over time, and that may not be applicable in another career opportunity. And so in a lot of cases, you know, kind of workers are faced with three choices. It's, you know, I kind of have to uproot my whole life and try and move to somewhere else where I can find a similar job if it exists. I can take a huge pay cut and try and just find the first job that I can find regardless of where it is, what it's doing or what it'll pay me. Or I can, you know, kind of potentially try and hold out for a similar job in my local area, and who knows how long that'll take. And so it is something that has a serious human cost. It can potentially be years for some long-term displaced workers, and it's the type of thing that, you know, when you look at other countries that are really successful at adapting their economies to, you know, these kind of emerging trends, places like Germany comes to mind, Denmark is another one, Sweden. What they do is they invest a lot more, both on the federal level, but also kind of on the community level, in their workforce. And so that includes things like what Mark was alluding to around support for displaced workers financially, directing them into training programs, providing financial support for those programs, things like basic childcare, healthcare, you know, for workers when they're in these transitions. And these are things that, you know, the U.S. has not done very well for a long time. And in a lot of ways, we're kind of trending in the wrong direction, I'd say.
So
one thing that's interesting is I think it's a misnomer to think that we haven't already been contending with, you know, automation. And you've been, again, as Rob said, you've had a front row seat on 45 years of, you know, quite wrenching transitions that have gone well for some firms and some people and some places, and have been harder for others. So I think more is coming that will affect more of the population. And I think Rob and I, you know, are thinking that, you know, as you're saying, places are going to need to get better at helping people ride through the changes.
Are there any places that are doing that now? Do you know of any cities that are successful with this transition?
I mean, there are quite a lot of places that are certainly circling around, you know, really trying to develop an understanding of what is happening. I think this is an area where there's a lot of experiment, but not a really comprehensive effort. I think a lot of places are working on it.
Yeah, there's some anecdotes, but part of the problem in the U.S. right now is there's some good ideas, but many of them aren't at scale. And, you know, we have one of the largest scales in the world that we need to achieve, right? We have a population of 330 million, a workforce of 200 million plus. And so that's just – it's a different scale than many other places in the world. And so that's one of the big issues. So, you know, there are anecdotes. There's some good work going on in, you know, Cuyahoga County around, you know, their skill up program, which is actually helping, you know, workers in this kind of lifelong learning mindset. But, it, you know, the problem is taking them from kind of county level examples into state or national level examples. Experimentation is going on, but, you know, you need some state and federal support behind that to bring, you know, local anecdotes into national stories, and that hasn't really happened.
I mean, one area that really has been on, you know, on the forefront, I think, is Washington State, which has a heavy manufacturing history, but now is at the absolute cutting edge of AI. So they are exposed on both ends. And so they've just had their first statewide legislatively mandated, you know, comprehensive future of work study that is trying to then, you know, get everyone on the same page on what is happening and then guide education and training institutions. I think that's, you know, it's going to take – this is going to be, you know, a decade of change, I think, for, you know, public efforts.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Michael Monks. I'm talking today with Mark Murrow. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And Robert Maxim. Hi, Rob.
Hey, great to be with you.
They are both of the Brookings Institution, and they're the authors of Automation and Artificial Intelligence, How Machines Are Affecting People and Places. They've also studied where the growth companies are, where the innovation companies are, and it seems that they are in the coastal big cities and not so much in the heartland. And Mark, why don't you start out telling us what you found in terms of where these innovation industries are setting up shop?
Yeah, absolutely. You named it fairly clearly. Our recent work on what we're calling growth centers, which are, you know, the most dynamic places with very high levels of what we call innovation industries, with high R&D and high STEM work, people are not wrong to perceive that mostly these are somewhere else, namely on the coast. We've gotten quite used to the idea that big coastal high-tech metro areas were pulling away from the rest of the country. And it's interesting to reflect that, in fact, 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. And most places were catching up. The South was catching up with the rest of the country. Hinterland places or heartland places were catching up with the big cities. That's no longer true. And we call that pattern divergence. And we think we live in an era of divergence that is really exacerbated in this decade, in which a very short list of places, let's say Seattle, the Bay Area, San Diego, Boston, are not just pulling away, they're dominating actual employment growth in this short list of what we call innovation industries. We calculated that literally more than 90% of new jobs in the innovation sector, as we defined it, were accounted for by growth in those five metropolitan areas. So our view is that is a very unhealthy state of affairs for the country. It's one that has significant economic complications. It may well be a drag on the nation's capacity. It's creating tremendous social costs. And really, I would say it raises matters of fairness. If you happen to be based in the 90% of the country that is not immediately affected by one of these, you know, super titanic growth centers. And then I think it has political side effects. People are voting against remote elites. So this is, I think, a problem that's been gaining force in the last couple decades and has become very visible and challenging in this decade.
Rob?
You know, the one thing I'd add in kind of bringing it back to the, you know, the Cincinnati context a bit is, and Mark can kind of, I think, elaborate a bit more on kind of where we're thinking of going, is, you know, Cincinnati has some of the assets that would be needed to turn it into a major growth center. You know, Mark mentioned kind of these major innovation industries that have, you know, significant levels of STEM employment and, you know, research and development and kind of the economic spillovers from there. And so those exist. They exist in particular on the coasts and kind of in particular in the five or six areas that are dominating innovation growth. But that doesn't mean that's the only place that they exist. And actually, you know, Cincinnati has a decent stock of firms and of industries that, you know, are doing R&D and that hire STEM workers and that, you know, have, you know, significant job shares with kind of long economic spillover effects and in long supply chains. And, you know, when you look at not just the innovation sector, but kind of what we call the broader, you know, advanced sector, which is, you know, a set of advanced manufacturing, advanced services industries, and a couple advanced energy production industries, they actually have a pretty decent concentration in Cincinnati. These are industries that also do a significant amount of R&D, which again has, you know, important benefits for not only cities but the communities around them. They have, you know, significantly educated workforces, but then they also provide opportunities for workers without a BA to potentially make a better living than they otherwise would have. And Cincinnati has a lot of those assets. And so, you know, we are in the current position we are because of a lot of kind of path dependency over the past 20 to 30 years. We've kind of gotten complacent and this is where it's been. But when you think, you know, it doesn't mean that that's the destiny of the country moving forward. And in fact, I think policy could, you know, really shift some of the geography here and help at least share, you know, some of these benefits with places like Cincinnati because they have a stock of assets already.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think our argument in this work, we didn't simply do it to, you know, demonstrate that a lot of places are being left behind. We also wanted to make the point that absent action, if we do nothing, you know, we're going to get a certain kind of geography. So our idea is that the nation should, you know, have a huge competition to identify, you know, 8 to 10 places in the heartland that have excellent potential, that have great research universities, that have really strong existing advanced industries presence and innovation capacity, such as Rob was talking about, and then we should just pile on to those. Let's take those 8 to 10 places and have what we call an innovation surge over the next 10 years. Let's spend $100 billion on this. And let's see if we can shove 8 to 10 places onto a takeoff transition. We think we've never really tried this, and we think it could work. And
does anybody really want that to happen, though? I mean, do the companies really want to do that, or are they happy the way they are?
Interestingly, on the one hand, the coastal tech companies have been, at least for public consumption, some of the most concerned about these dynamics.
I think they're concerned about some of the backlash that's kind of come up, you know.
And I think investors are aware that there are great ideas that aren't getting funded in the heartland. And then politically, you know, in rolling out this idea, we've been cautiously optimistic at the, you know, bipartisan interest in doing something very significant in this area. For Ohioans, we did a calculation, did some analysis to see how many places are out there that have a legitimate presence to become America's next, you know, growth, you know, high-tech growth center. We calculated 35 nationally. We found 5 of them, Columbus, Akron, Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Dayton, all fit that bill of being an up-and-coming place with significant technical university and talent resources.
What can these communities do then to really attract that? What can the communities do to help that happen, assuming that makes sense to have it happen in these areas?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in many respects, many communities are doing much of what one might hope. States are investing in their universities as much as they can. Regions are building high-tech ecosystems. Lots of startup efforts are underway. And of course, always important is increasing technical skills, STEM skills. But our argument is that on their own, by themselves, these efforts are probably going to be insufficient because of this kind of lockdown, lock-in of technology economies that are all about agglomerations, clustering of skilled people. So we're going to need to interrupt business as usual in this nation. And, you know, I think there's a widening sense that the current trajectory is not a winning one for the nation. And so we'll see. You're right to maybe be a little skeptical.
But, how do you break that up? You say you have to change the way that's working. How do you do that?
You spend $100 billion of R&D investments. Really, we have a $100 billion package.
What city has that kind of money, though? My gosh.
No, none of the cities do, but the federal government would need as a nation to mobilize that kind of effort.
So this doesn't come cheap.
No, and the idea would be let's create 10 more mini Silicon Valleys with their own particular starting point, their own technologies, their own latent talent. Mm-hmm. But the starting point is a massive influx of R&D spending into Research One universities, such as you have, such as many of the Ohio cities do.
And just to jump in and kind of build off Mark's point, you know, one thing I'd say is the current tech hubs in the United States didn't become one in a vacuum. You know, Silicon Valley didn't just appear one day. You know, Route 128 in Massachusetts didn't just appear one day. The Research Triangle in North Carolina didn't just appear one day. And they also, I mean, I hate to say it, it wasn't just the market that ended up creating these places either. They were government investments in areas like, you know, silicon chips in Silicon Valley, right? Like that's where the name comes from, microprocessors, you know, biotechnology, you know, major areas of technology that are now having huge spillover effects economically. And, you know, these were government investments. And so it's something that the country has done for a while and has kind of forgotten about. And, you know, that's why we're on the path we're on now, where kind of the incumbent places are doing well because they received kind of a push-off, you know, a couple decades ago, and then we kind of withdrew from that. And so what we're arguing in a lot of ways is, you know, we need to go back to that formula that we had when we made these really successful places like Silicon Valley or Boston or North Carolina or pick and choose a couple of different areas. I mean, Washington, D.C. is kind of taking off in some ways now. And why is that? It's part of it is because of, you know, the industrial presence here, but we also have the federal government. So, you know, it's not always the free market that pushes this off. And a lot of times you actually, you know, do need to overcome market failures. And that's kind of one of the points we're trying to make here.
As you talk to me from Washington, D.C. today, tell me, has anybody come to you and said, this is a very interesting report, we want to learn more and then do something? Have you heard from anybody in the government that seems interested?
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually more than we've expected. On the one hand, we've been criticized by some for naming too small a number, which is interesting. Some think that the problem is so large that it merits even larger intervention.
More than $100 billion? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes. But leaving that aside, what's interesting is the bipartisan nature of, you know, I think, interest on Capitol Hill.
Well, that is interesting because you don't hear much bipartisan today. So,
yeah. What's interesting, I think historically there has been a consensus around specifically R&D and maybe more broadly innovation. So there's nothing more American. Research universities are still broadly seen as crown jewels of their states and their senators and their delegations. So I think there's interest in that. And then, you know, our identification of 35 potential transformative growth centers places of places identifies places that are almost are heavily within red states
and swing states.
So you know, I think you know there's lots of reasons to be very uncertain of the future around this kind of proposal, but we have felt that there has been far better response than we expected, and I think it is because we still respect the innovation agenda in this country, and we've seen its benefits.
We are out of time. We could talk about this all day, but so thank you so much. This is so interesting. I really appreciate you.
Well, thanks so much.
Appreciate you both joining me today.
Thank you, Marianne. I've been talking
with the authors of Automation and Artificial Intelligence, How Machines Are Affecting People and Places, Mark Muro and Robert Maxim of the Brookings Institution. In just a moment, we'll talk about a new IT program at the University of Cincinnati that helps to train students for their careers. This is Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks. As part of the ongoing initiative American Graduate Getting to Work, we're talking today about the University of Cincinnati's information technology programs and the 1819 Innovation Hub and how they're helping students prepare for the workforce. Joining me are Chief Innovation Officer at the University of Cincinnati, David Adams. Hi, David.
Hi.
Professor and Director of the School of Information Technology at the University of Cincinnati, Hazem Saeed. Hello.
Hello, Maria.
And also the Leader of Strategy and Architecture for Merchant Solutions of FIS, Rich Hill. Hi, Rich.
Hello.
And we should also mention you're a former University of Cincinnati student.
Absolutely.
Go Bearcats.
To get started, we just finished up a conversation in the first half of the program with folks from the Brookings Institution talking about AI and how it's really revolutionizing the workforce. And David, maybe you can address that about how things really have changed even since 2005 when Rich graduated.
Well, what's changing dramatically is we live in this knowledge economy now. And as you know, with Brookings, it's all about talent clusters and having cities that have talent clusters as a mechanism to attract and retain talent. So one of the key things that we did with the 1819 Innovation Hub, the president of the university, President Pinto, charged me with connecting the economic engine of the University of Cincinnati, connect it with the community. So we use the 1819 Innovation Hub as a place where everything from startups to Fortune 500 businesses can connect with the talent of the university, be it student talent, research talent, or educational talent. So we're connecting real business problems with students from a learning perspective and providing opportunities for employers to engage those students in ways that would be difficult if not physically being co-located next to the university.
Tell me how it's changed from 5 or 10 years ago to AI now and what it's doing to the workforce.
You know, what's interesting today is that the pace of change is unprecedented. If you think back even to the early 1800s, we're very much an agricultural society. Then as we had a turn of the century in the 1900s, we became this manufacturing or industrial society. Really, in the last 20 years, we're now in this knowledge economy. And the pace of change means that we need to be almost co-located to be able to collaborate in new and exciting ways. So having this innovation center and ultimately this innovation district that we're building is a way for collaborations and co-creation to be able to occur, not only between students and companies, but companies to other companies as well. So it's just proximity matters, and having that closeness, it becomes really important.
Hazem, tell me a little bit about the teaching that you do and what you're trying to ingrain in the students now.
And to build on what you were just describing with David, is technology has evolved significantly and very fast, and things like artificial intelligence, cloud technologies, Internet of Things, and big data have revolutionized how every organization and every process works. So we see our responsibility is to evolve as fast as the technology evolving and to offer our community pathway to learning and to earning degrees and to advance their education. So our region will have the strongest talent. I put them in three things: the highest number, the quality, the quantity, and the diversity of talent. And in information technology is really about having people who can help you and I leverage technology to achieve our work goals, personal goals, and to improve our lives in general. And we started several years ago to create our own understanding and definition for the IT professional of the future. And the IT professional of the future is the one who's selecting solutions for us, integrating, creating it if needed, administering it and deploying it, and working in several domains like cybersecurity, app development, web development, and so on and so forth. And for that professional to be successful, we identified three key skills: hands-on skills, problem-solving skills, and communication skills. And we took upon ourselves the challenge to provide a reasonable pathway for everyone who wants one, whether they are young students out of high school or adult learners or people who wants to enter this IT field. We have a reasonable path for each one who wants one.
And we should mention the 1819 Innovation Hub works not only with college students, but with high school students
as well. And we work very closely with David and under his direction and strategies as he connects the university economic engine and the university talent to the industry and the community. We're supplying him with the talent and trying to be nimble and dynamic in adjusting our curriculum and our offering so that our students, when they graduate, what I say to them, their resume suddenly jump on the top of all other resumes.
Well, what is it that you're teaching them? How do you do that, the more specifics that really make a difference for helping them deal with this whole new way of doing things?
I think the first step was for us to do a soul searching and understand what is needed to succeed as an IT professional. And then how do we help every person, regardless of the learning? So for instance, we emphasize the hands-on skills, which is like practice. So we tell people learning IT is like learning music or learning sports. It comes with practice. So if you're willing to put yourself into practice, you will master that skill and advance to the level that you need to be, and to work with the faculty to incorporate new technologies quickly. So if a technology like AI, like cloud technologies, when they become available, they immediately reflected at our undergraduate and grad. And I want to mention something that we also recognize: it takes a village to achieve that. So we built 3 years ago extensive partnerships with school districts and community colleges and the industry so that all of us together are working to increase the accessibility and effectiveness of our education pathways.
Rich, you graduated in 2005. Was AI, artificial intelligence, or IT, information technology, even around then?
I mean, AI and machine learning have been around since the early 60s when we think about neural networks and where the beginnings of those have come from. But it's really just been in the last 5 to 10 years that those technologies have become accessible and pervasive enough to now we can leverage them in a university setting, in an industry setting, in a really broad-reaching way. We're able to now take things and like artificial intelligence, apply that to fraud detection in terms of how we identify fraud coming into payment systems today, something that we probably wouldn't have been able to do just 10 years ago, right? But being able to develop these models more quickly, have them respond to the way that that we see user behaviors, that's really incredible and something we're able to exploit now.
So you work with the university, correct, and part of this program. What is it that your business, FIS, is trying to do to work with the university to help those students who are getting out of school be ready to go when it's time to come to a company like yours?
Yeah, at FIS, we're really concerned with making sure that we're getting great talent coming in directly out of college and even actually during their college. We bring them in for co-op rotations and intern rotations from other universities as well. We serve on industry advisory boards in the School of Information Technology, the College of Engineering throughout the university, as well as other universities, helping to inform what are the skills that we need going forward to make sure that that's part of the curriculum and we can help influence that curriculum and let the universities know what skills are needed right now or are needed in the near future that we're going to need to be prepared for.
David, one of the things that has been an issue, and we heard from the Brookings Institution representatives, it's the funding and the money that is there or perhaps is not there to really make this work. How is your what is the funding for the University of Cincinnati in these programs, and how do you think that compares to funding that's just coming into the Midwest in general as opposed to the coast and the coastal cities?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So it has to be truly a public-private partnership in order for this to work. So the university, through the development of an old Sears building, has created the 1819 Innovation Hub. That was an investment by the University of Cincinnati. But partners like FIS are actually have spaces there, and they're paying for the cost associated with those spaces. But the key piece of this is that how do we continue to develop these public-private partnerships? So as an example, we're also building, or we're not building, but we got a developer building, another 370,000 square feet adjacent to the 1819 Innovation Hub, what we're calling the Digital Futures Complex. And that's a private developer bringing that real estate out of the ground. University of Cincinnati is committed through the Digital Futures to take about 50% of that particular development, but industry will connect with the other 50%. So we see this truly as evolving into being a public-private partnership. But to your point about the coast, one of the challenges that we have here in Cincinnati and throughout the Midwest is how do we accelerate this effort? If you look at Silicon Valley, you know, they've been at this for 70 years. Even if you go up to Boston, they've been up this for, you know, approximately 30 to 40 years. We're just getting this started, and we're doing everything we can to accelerate, which means this has to be a team effort with the city, the state, the university, and private organizations helping to develop the tech talent pipeline that is so needed in this community. And we're committed to making Cincinnati a destination location for tech talent, both at the collegiate level, but also, how do we start to influence high school students and really inspire them to think about digital futures and think about the opportunities in the digital world and then bring that to fruition here in Cincinnati as opposed to developing that talent here and then having that talent go to the coast or to some other location? It's really, really important for all of us to pull together in true partnership and make this happen.
Azam, your thoughts on that?
I have many thoughts, but one of them is the what David mentioned about we're in a talent economy. And what this means for listeners is the organization, the region who has the most skilled talent at the right time is the one that will thrive and survive. And that is different than 20, 30 years ago. And that talent, also we are in knowledge economy or information economy. And you put this together, we can understand a little bit what David was mentioning about the need for technology. These are the two key ingredients for the future. The ability of an organization or a community to have the talent who can leverage the wealth of information and data that they have. We cannot do that if we continue to do business as usual. We have to make a stop and re-examine ourselves and invent in our education programs as well as our partnerships. One of the innovative programs we have, we call it the Early Information Technology Initiative, where we decided to take the undergraduate degree and share it with the high school district. So students can start on the path towards the baccalaureate degree in high school. And we introduce, the University of Cincinnati is the only Research One university who introduced this, what we call automatic admission, that if a student starts on the path towards the IT degree in high school, successfully completes the freshman year, we guarantee to them to be admitted into the baccalaureate of information technology at the University of Cincinnati. Not only that, we have the reinvented the co-op program, which you see has founded 100 years ago, and we were just ranked number one in the nation in co-op. What the co-op program does is two things. First, it gives the students income to help them with the college cost. And number two, it connects them with the industry early on in the learning journey. So the student is learning and working with the industry and mixing the theoretical experience in the classroom with the practical experience of the workplace. And we added to that what we call the accelerated program, where students add on a master degree in a diverse contextual areas like business administration, healthcare, and so on and so forth. So now a student out of high school can receive direct access to their degree, complete an undergraduate degree, a master degree, and 20 months of paid work experience in just 4 years after high school. And some students can accelerate that even further. What this means to our industry is they have access to a large pool of talent very early on in the learning journey. And our goal working with David and industry like Rich is to provide the right talent at the right time to the industry.
Rich, you can talk about that with your company, since your company's involved with this. Once these students are working with you, what happens next? I mean, once they graduate, are you ready to hire them, or do they go into other companies? Are they hireable right out of school?
Yeah, the co-op experience really leads directly into our full-time employment programs. We really love it as a feeder into it. Being the world's largest fintech company, significantly dedicated to Cincinnati and staying and growing in Cincinnati, we really like being able to begin the talent journey early on, whether it's at the high school level working with groups like InterAlliance and getting ready with the early IT program, then throughout the co-op journey while they're in school, whether it's information technology, computer science, computer engineering, electrical engineering, or other majors like finance and accounting. We love bringing them in. It's a great opportunity for the students to get real-world practical experience that pays, for us to actually be able to evaluate that talent to make sure it is going to be the right fit, and then to have a direct onboarding ramp into our full-time employment as soon as they're graduating.
You mentioned fintech. Explain what that is.
So fintech, right?
Or
so,
fintech. I'm sorry. See, I really need you to explain it.
Yeah, financial technologies. So really, when you look at FIS, we're the leaders in payments, in banking, and in investing. And I think having a significant presence with the world's largest fintech company, especially our payments group really located here in Cincinnati, provides a great opportunity to partner with the university to have students, to give students exposure to the world of fintech early on.
Now, you're not the, I'm sorry.
I was going to say this is a perfect example of what David was talking about, was how technology is transforming everything. 20 years ago, nobody knew what fintech is. Maybe even 10 years ago, but how technology is coming into banking and the financial sector, it's changing the game. And now we have fintech, and we need technologies and talent. So it speaks to what David was talking about earlier.
Do you feel like you work, Rich, with the other companies that are there? Well, you're not the only one. I mean, are you guys competing for these talented students, or are you happy with the ones you get and you're willing to give some to the other companies? How's that go?
I think it's very collaborative, and it has to be collaborative. There are other great partners in this space like Kroger, Fifth Third Bank, Kingsgate Logistics. There's a bunch of other great companies that are there. And it does need to be a collaborative experience. I think the university is doing a great job providing enough talent. We're always looking for talent, and it's definitely a tight market. But they're doing a great job being able to source the right students for the right skill sets that each one of us has. So the skills that we need inside of FIS are not necessarily exactly the same skills that you might need at a Kroger or you might need at Cincy Tech. But it's been a great experience so far, and we're looking forward to continuing to collaborate with the other tenants in the space.
David, as we wrap things up, I was going to ask you, what do you think the future holds?
Well, I think the future is bright for Cincinnati relative to being a tech destination spot, not only for the talent that we're building here in the state, but one of the key pieces with the Innovation Hub and this overall innovation district is that companies like FIS can actually bring experienced hires from outside Cincinnati to Cincinnati, show them the wonderful opportunities that are here, and truly make this a destination location and not a step on the journey. So I think the future is very bright. We just got to continue to accelerate. And also, one of the things that, you know, we don't do real well here in the Midwest is talk about ourselves. So we've got to continue to really talk about this, not only just a regional, but a national global basis about all the wonderful opportunities right here in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Do you find, and this very briefly, but do you find that you're getting students from across the country now wanting to come here, or are you getting students mostly from the Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana area?
Well, we're a regional university today, but what's interesting is our applications this year are up at a record level. Our enrollment continues to grow, and we continue to see that that's going to continue for some time. So we're really excited about that, but we're also excited that as experienced hires come to Cincinnati, they're starting to see the wonderful opportunities that are here. And so it gives us an opportunity for individuals, too, that may have been here, that have relocated somewhere else, to absolutely come back to Cincinnati and be a part of this community.
Thank you all so much for being here today. It's really been a pleasure. I've learned a lot. Fintech versus Vintech, if nothing else.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking today about the University of Cincinnati's information technology programs, the 18-19 Innovation Hub, and how to prepare students for the workforce. My guests have been Chief Innovation Officer at the University of Cincinnati, David Adams, Professor and Director of the School of Information Technology at the University of Cincinnati, Hazem Saeed, and Leader of Strategy and Architecture for Merchant Solutions of FIS, Rich Hill. Producer for today's program is Elise Meckler. Our assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Today's technical director, Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks.